A retired justice speaks. Playboy goes for female viewers. Religion and public education. The end of the post office, but no end to procrastination. It's Tuesday, October 5, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Justice John Paul Stevens of the U.S. Supreme Court may have retired, but he's still in his expansive chambers until his new offices are prepared, and he's still talking. Monday marked the first time in nearly 35 years that Justice Stevens has not sat on the nation's highest court. He did give USA Today an interview. In the interview, he spoke of his colleagues, not only his more liberal colleagues, but his conservative colleagues as well, and he said this, quote, "In time, the court will straighten itself out. Judges change over time as they do the work, and there are fine judges on the court right now, and in the long run, you can be sure they'll do a good job," end quote. Now, partly, that quote looks rather innocuous. It looks almost gracious, as Justice Stevens, here now in his first day of formal retirement, is speaking with appreciation and friendship to his former colleagues, his conservative fellow justices, as well as those who voted with him in the liberal bloc. But a closer examination of the statement indicates that, in context, Justice Stevens was suggesting that eventually justices and judges tend to move in a more liberal direction. Given enough time, they, well, let's be honest about how the press describes it, grow in office. That growth always moves in a liberal direction. You never hear the national media or the intellectual elites speak of someone growing into a more conservative direction. According to their progressivist understanding of history, but not only world history, but even personal history, things have to move leftward or they are not progress. Progress always points in a more liberal direction to their worldview, and that's why Justice Stevens, now retired at age 90, is certain that even his conservative colleagues, given enough time, would end up where he is. Time was that pornography was fairly easy to understand. Playboy, for example, was a magazine, infamous and notorious, but well identified in terms of its place in the culture. But now Playboy is ubiquitous, even as pornography has gone mainstream and in a diverse number of marketing areas. But now Playboy has a TV channel. And according to the Wall Street Journal, Playboy TV has a new proposition. It wants to bring in women viewers. Now, one of the interesting aspects of this particular news story is that Playboy actually does not intend to draw female viewers in just as female viewers. It turns out that that is generally a losing marketing strategy. Instead, they are trying to draw in women who would watch along with male partners, couples watching pornography. As Russell Adams of the Wall Street Journal reports, last year Playboy began spreading the message to Hollywood producers. It was looking for series that couples could watch together and was offering a platform that allowed for, quote, creative freedom and expression, end quote. That, by the way, is something that most networks don't offer. Playboy received hundreds of pitches from a wide range of people, according to Mr. Adams, including some mainstream Hollywood producers. Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens here. We're likely to read some business report in subsequent editions of the Wall Street Journal about whether this did or did not work. After all, pornography is big business. Even the nation's most illustrious business journal keeps a fairly close watch on the pornography industry, which is estimated by some to be the nation's seventh largest business sector. Regardless of how it is computed, pornography has gone mainstream. It is now available in a variety of sources and a myriad of devices, and it will not be long until pornography is virtually ubiquitous in this culture given the direction of advertising and entertainment, as well as what used to be called smut. We face here the reality that pornography is a big industry, and as an industry, like others, it is seeking to broaden its customer base. In order to do that, it is having to redefine itself as a product and, as is apparent in this news article, to try to reach out to women as well as to men. One of the interesting observations made by many people over the last several years is that women have their own new forms of what has to be described as pornography. Many romance novels are nothing but pornography set in narrative form. As it turns out, in a fallen world, pornography is not only going to take a myriad of forms, it is going to reach out to a myriad of markets. Given the drive of every industry to increase market share, you can count on pornographers doing their dead-level best to increase whatever market share they can gain from whatever sector of the population. In a most bizarre turn of a phrase, the Wall Street Journal suggests that this latest move to increase market share on the part of Playboy indicates that Playboy has gone female-friendly. I guess we'll see how many females fall for that line. As already discussed, the Pew Forum on Religion in American Public Life is out with a new major study of American religion. This one on just how much Americans know, not only about their own faith, but about others. The fact is that most Americans had to turn in a failing grade. Embarrassingly enough, most Christians seem to know actually very little about Christianity. As you look at the knowledge of other religions, well, the score just gets worse. Now, the Pew Forum is interested in this in terms of the American social experiment. Many Christians will look at this in terms of the devastating results of a study that shows that most who identify themselves as Christians actually know quite little about Christianity. In USA Today, Stephen Prothero, a professor at Boston University, is suggesting that the public schools bear a good deal of this responsibility. He has written in the past as an advocate for religious literacy. And now he suggests that one reason that the public schools have backed off of any considerable education of their pupils about the religions of the world is that the educators are afraid that court decisions have rendered such education unconstitutional. He suggests that most Americans, and indeed most educators, believe, quote, that the First Amendment guarantees of disestablishment somehow mandate that our public schools be religion-free zones where teachers and administrators conspire to pretend that there are no Muslims or Hindus in the world, end quote. Now, Professor Prothero is a keen observer of many of these issues, and when it comes to religious literacy, he himself has written some of the most interesting material. But I find it fascinating that when he talks about how educators and citizens have been scared off by court decisions, he mentions that the schools now pretend that there are no Muslims or Hindus in the world. Of course, they pretend even more than this that there are no Christians in America. One thing is right in Stephen Prothero's analysis, and that is this. Many Americans, many educators, and indeed many lower courts have just assumed that the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions on church and state and religious liberty have rendered the public schools a religion-free zone. That's not exactly so. But the courts themselves bear a good deal of this responsibility. And when it comes to that impression, well, it's not just about the knowledge of world religions. It's about the fact that most educators, school boards, and indeed a frighteningly large percentage of American citizens think that Christianity itself, held by the vast majority of American citizens, just can't be discussed in public, and in particular, in the public schools. Stephen Prothero is right that that's just dead wrong. In another reminder of how our society is changing so fast before our eyes, Investor's Business Daily was out on Monday with a news story about living in a post-post office world. Many of us can remember when the mailman was a daily fixture of life, bringing something so antiquated as what we used to call a letter. Many of us now hardly receive first-class letters except an occasional thank you note or a birthday card. The reality is that the Postal Service has been falling in terms of first-class service, on which it holds a monopoly, year after year. Just recently, it was down 13% again in Postal Service fiscal year 2009. Congress is having to act, and one thing Congress did that was wise is to turn down the request from the Postal Regulatory Commission last week that first-class postage be raised to 46 cents from 44 cents. As the Investor's Business Daily documents, when a business is in trouble, it seldom is wise to raise its costs. But that's exactly what the Postal Service has tried to do, for it is largely under the sway of labor unions, and those labor unions are opposed to change. But as Investor's Business Daily points out, that change is happening anyway. One central piece of evidence of this is the fact that one central agency of the U.S. government is now going entirely electronic. That's right, the Internal Revenue Service has announced that it will no longer, in short order, be receiving or accepting paper tax filings. Now, for the IRS to take that step indicates that our nation's tax-collecting agency is convinced that it is no longer profitable or economic to receive tax returns and checks by mail. Investor's Business Daily is exactly right. The Postal Service may fight these changes, but it cannot stop them. This is true not only for the Postal Service, however, but for all sectors of society when it comes to the digital revolution. We look at this vast change happening so quickly around us, and we are reminded that something that was a fixture of our culture in fairly recent years, that first-class letter, is now fast disappearing in an age of email, instant messaging, text messaging, and all the rest. Of course, some of us never quite get around to the change we intend to make. That issue is raised in a fascinating way by James Surowiecki in the current issue of The New Yorker, dated October 11, 2010. In an article entitled Later, What Does Procrastination Tell Us About Ourselves?, Surowiecki reviews the literature, including a new book entitled The Thief of Time. Writing about procrastination, he offers some considerable insights. For instance, listen to this. According to Pierre Steele, a business professor at the University of Calgary, the percentage of people who admitted to difficulties with procrastination quadrupled between 1978 and 2002. In that light, it's possible to see procrastination as the quintessential modern problem. It's also a surprisingly costly one. Each year, Americans waste hundreds of millions of dollars because they do not file their taxes on time. The Harvard economist David Leibson has shown that American workers have foregone huge amounts of money in matching 401k contributions because they never get around to signing up for a retirement plan. 70% of patients suffering from glaucoma risk blindness because they don't use their eye drops regularly. Procrastination also inflicts major costs on businesses and governments. The recent crisis of the euro was exacerbated by the German government's dithering, and the decline of the American auto industry, exemplified by the bankruptcy of General Motors, was due in part to executives' penchant for delaying tough decisions. Now, that's a fascinating segment itself from this article. But Mr. Surowiecki goes on to suggest that the problem of procrastination isn't all that new. The Greeks called this kind of pattern akrasia, which meant doing something against your own best interest. But procrastinators intend to do something. They generally intend to do what they firmly believe is the right thing. They just put it off. One interesting aspect to Mr. Surowiecki's admission in this article is that even writers on procrastination tend to procrastinate in writing their articles. He wonders why procrastination happens. Well, Mr. Surowiecki, I don't think the psychologists and sociologists are going to have the final answer. I think the final answer about the why of procrastination goes back to Genesis 3 and human sinfulness. Even as we intend to do what we know we ought to do, we find ourselves putting it off. And not only that, we'll put it off again and again and again. Procrastination is one more sign of a fallen universe and fallen humanity. Procrastination may be, as this article suggests, the quintessentially modern problem, but it really is the quintessentially human problem. We are not the masters of our own time, but insofar as we have the stewardship of time, we do fall into the pattern of procrastination. That might be described as any number of syndromes. The Greeks may have described it in times of old, and modern psychiatrists and efficiency experts may try to describe it now, but we know that it is best known by a short three-letter word, sin. We also know that we should take a closer look at the sinfulness of procrastination and deal with it honestly. And as for most of us, we'll be determined to do that. Someday. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe not. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a wealth of resources for you at my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/albertmohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For more information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I am today in Lafayette, Indiana, where I'm speaking to the annual convention of the National Association of Nuthetic Counselors. In my keynote address last night, I talked about the communion of saints, the church, as the center of biblical counseling. Today, I'm going to be talking about what's missing from the worldview of most Christians, and that is an awareness of death. I'll talk about that and more when I meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.